Your host Matthew Ross, again accompanied by my co-host Michael Pontone. Say hi, Mike. How you doing?
Hello. You're never going to be able to nail that intro without stuttering something, but that's okay, yeah. Captain.
Well, you know, it's our second one, so we'll hammer it out as we go along. This
is true. Okay, this is Michael Pontone. This is Michael Pontone, co-host, first officer, wannabe aspirational Vulcan, reluctant Cardassian, joining my captain Matt Ross on yelling at gaseous anomalies. Two young attorneys, right, relatively, to the rest, yeah, of attorneys.
We are here looking at the second broadcast episode of Star Trek, the original series, Charlie X, or what I like to call the teenage drama, or as they call it, the adolescence episode. It's a very, what I would call, creepy story. It takes place where the Enterprise picks up someone who had been trapped on a planet for many a year, a 17-year-old, and it starts off with our, in the enhanced version, a brand new CGI version of the SS Antares, not a starship, but a scout ship, dropping off a young Charles Evans, played by Robert Walker Jr.
Captain, I have to point out that they didn't note it not as a scout ship, but a transport ship.
That's true. It is a transport ship. Kirk calls it a scout ship later. This is actually one of my favorite episodes because... Really? I think it has a lot to deal with growing up and a person dealing with various different episodes of their life. But what was your general impression of this show when you first saw it?
I dug it. Generally, I'm shocked as a person who's very new to the original series to see how many echoes of things and common concepts and common themes of TNG and DS9 and Voyager that were already being established, you know, 60 years ago. I do have a bunch of notes here starting from the beginning. Unlike last time, I'm trying to be a little bit more organized. Firstly, cargo vessel. It's the first time we're seeing a different Federation ship. I like that they're nailing the design already, the two nacelles and the bridge, even though it's completely different. You know, seeing different Federation ships that have very, very unique designs, but still have the commonality of the two nacelles on the bridge is going to be something that us as Star Trek fans see for many, many decades. But you're telling me that in the original release, we don't see that ship. There's not an exterior.
No, there isn't. And also, it's not even the Federation. It's called USPA, or USPA, the United Earth Space Probe Agency, which we actually don't get to know about until later. They haven't really nailed out what is this group that we're dealing with. It's not the Federation or Starfleet per se. It's
Merchant Marines.
Yeah, they're still new with this. So that both the show and the writers, so they're trying to figure out as they are going along. But what is neat is you can take a look when that other transport ship comes on. They're not wearing the same insignia. They look slightly harried and nervous and happy to get rid of that teenage guy, which, you know, I could say having an almost teenager, I can understand why I do have a teenager, why some people would be nervous having a teenager on their ship. No, I love my son a lot, Aaron. It's interesting, and it starts off right away where we meet Yeoman Rand. Are you a girl? Or is, yeah, that a girl? Yeah, she's definitely a girl, I'll tell you that much, with her chessboard or checkerboard hair wig. It's pretty funny to see that, by the way.
Yeah, yeah, interesting. So again, I'm brand new to the series. I didn't realize that Yeoman Rand was going to be such a major part of the first few episodes. I had seen, Lieutenant Rand, the character. I knew that she was from the original series in, from the little lingering shots that we saw in the TOS movies. She's, mm-hmm, of course, in Undiscovered Country. She's part of Sulu's bridge team on the Excelsior. And randomly, she's at the Federation headquarters in Star Trek 3. I mean, sorry, 4. Voyage Home. But apparently, she's got a bigger role in Search for Spock, which I have to admit is probably the one movie that I've seen the least of. So I don't know one like the back of my hand.
She actually is watching the Enterprise coming in, shaking her head. Yeah, but she was supposed to originally have a thing with Captain Kirk. Later we can talk about when we get to that. That's a different issue. But In this one, she is the captain's yeoman, a secretary, basically, of the commanding officer over there. That actually comes up later. But it's interesting that we have this kid or 17-year-old stuck on a planet for many a years as a sole survivor of a crashed cargo vessel, and his only contact is the ship's computers talking to him. And then very suspiciously, as McCoy asks him in sickbay, how did you survive when the ship's food stores ran out? And he says, I found things. That should have already been a first concern. And so was also the Antares quickly trying to run away, going like, yeah, we got to go. Even though the Enterprise has a lot more stores and things, you would think a small vessel would be interested in taking, like, as Captain Kirk offers, you want entertainment videos? We got the latest stuff. Or you want some booze? Saurian brandy? Went, no, we're good. And they quickly run away, which is a little bit strange. Usually people would trade stuff just because they're so far out in space. What was your thinking of that? Did you have an inkling that there was something wrong other than that is the name of the character is Charlie and this guy comes on? Or?
Well, yeah, I mean, a gaggle of different things. Obviously, he's not right. Obviously, those guys want to get out of there. Seeing, again, interesting writing, like, you know, obviously, things don't get as bad as they do on the Enterprise when they're on the transport ship. They just kind of get weirded out by the guy. I doubt that the guy starts making people disappear or blanking their faces or something. When I heard the food thing, the food rations, I did think there was just going to be a straight cannibalism twist. Like there was going to be, something out of like Firefly with the Berserker
Ravagers, eating flesh.
I thought that secretly he was just going to turn out to be like a serial killer or something. A couple of different things. One thing that they drop early, and again, I took notes as I was watching it. Things that took that got me interested. Only 428 crew members on a Constitution class starship. That's substantially smaller, probably what, one quarter of what's on the Galaxy class?
Yes.
And I was saying, is this the Dr. Crusher episode where she's losing track of people and they're all getting sucked into a different dimension? But no, it would show. There's no Constitution class, there are no kids, there's no holodeck, there's no 10 forward.
There's no carpeting.
No carpeting, no Captain Kirk Day for the kids. yes, no school. So, it's a smaller vessel, and it's obviously supposed to be more of a, like you said, a warship.
It's not necessarily a warship. It's more of a working-class vessel. I mean, you see, as Charlie's walking through, you see, like, some guy wiring, people walking in, that they were going through and picking up various, it's basically they're working through their workday, an actual ship and fleet doing stuff. You saw two guys coming out of what's not yet named as a Jeffrey's tube trying to fix things. So that was interesting. That's where Charlie gets the idea to hit someone on the butt.
Right.
When talking to him, the guy goes, see you in the rec room. Yeah, friend. And he hits someone on the butt. How many times have you hit someone on the butt after a conversation?
Let me also point out here. Like, I dig the racial diversity. Already he's inserting it. I dig that there is, again, mirroring like the 18th century ships. Those guys are not officers. They're merely like crewmen. They're not wearing any sort of Starfleet insignia. And talk about Star Trek, the TOS being the first instance of an interracial kiss. That is definitely the first instance of an interracial butt slap right there. I mean, when's the last time? When in television history did you sooner see a white man slap a black man on the ass?
You know, I can't really put my finger on that one, nor do I want to, but I'll let you do the research to tell our listeners about that later.
That's it. I'm taking off of work. I'm delving deep into this history of black, white ass-slapping in media.
Oh, well, while you're doing that, what's interesting is how obsessed Charlie is with Yeoman Rand. Grace Lee Whitney is actually older than him in the show.
36 years old.
36, but he's actually 17. Neither of them are those ages.
She was 36 when they filmed this.
But that's what's it, and he's 26. But
she's a damn good-looking 36 for 1966, man. I thought that people who were 36 in 1966 looked like they were 50.
I've met her at several conventions. She was actually very nice all the time, and she did say about that checkerboard headpiece was rather heavy. But I like the fact that he gives her something from the ship stores. So this is pre-replicators.
Right.
He hands her something and goes like, "Isn't this your favorite perfume?" "Yes. How'd you know?" That's also should also be an issue at that point as well. You can see already there's that puppy love. Since we were both teenage males, I'm sure you had some sort of youthful obsession. We all can relate to that in some way.
Although oddly, I have to say, I was always distinctly not attracted, even as a hormonal young man, to any of the crew of TNG. They were all pretty tame.
Well, in TOS, I mean, the short skirts help, but I think Yeoman Rand's actually quite pretty, and so is.
Oh yes. No. TOS. That's something else. In fact, leads me to my next point here. We go to not 10 forward, rec room 6 or whatever, and just like last episode, there's a lot more flirting between Uhura and Spock, and Spock even cracks a smile, which already shows that a nice choice by Leonard Nimoy, showing that he was playing the character not as a character with no emotion, as a character that suppresses their emotions.
I don't think it's flirting. I think she was actually in the original script. She was supposed to be making fun of Mr. Spock. So I think the song that she's singing, talking about the man with Satan's guise, which is the line in the song. I don't know if that's necessary flirting. Although the song does make it seem like you better watch yourself, ladies, around this guy.
Well, yeah, and also that speaks to something I read years ago, that the Vulcan design was originally supposed to be demonic. He's supposed to have red skin and raised eyebrows and pointed ears, kind of like a demon without the horns. And they lost the red skin for, I think, censorship purposes, but they kept the pointy ears. So I don't know, maybe that Satan song was a holdover when he was supposed to look more like Satan.
But it was also, she's got a nice set of pipes. That is Nichelle Nichols singing. But if you think back to, I believe, The Man Trap, that's also her singing as Nancy's, the wife, the salt sucker coming in. They just dubbed it on in. She had a nice song voice. And then Charlie, realizes he's the butt of the jokes, and as he's trying to flirt with Janice, he eye rolls them into silence, which is interesting. And it began to remind me of a Twilight Zone episode, It's a Good Life.
Oh, of course. Oh, I saw A Good Life, Billy Mumy, all over this. I mean, to the point where I actually went and looked at the wiki page to see if any of these folks had indeed written for or worked on the Twilight Zone, because Twilight Zone would have been about 6 years before. And no, it didn't. However, I did see that the writer of the episode, who was a lady, am I getting that right? Was it a writer or the director? No, it was the writer of the episode. She was quite young. She was 25 when she wrote it, which means that during her formative years, when she was thinking about being a writer probably as a teenager, she probably tuned in and saw It's a Good Life, the Twilight Zone episode with Billy Mumy, where he's very, very similar to Charlie X here.
Well, you're talking about DC Fontana, who was originally Gene Roddenberry's secretary and then became one of the preeminent forces in Star Trek. By the way, Gene Roddenberry also, just as you pointed it out, as I did as well, he appears in this episode by voice as the chief of what, who knows, I guess the mess. Charlie also able to change his meatloaf into actual turkeys, because this is taking place during American Thanksgiving back on Earth. Again, this is the ship is essentially part of the United States Navy in space, so that's what it's based on slightly, down to the name. But they're talking about what they're going to have for dinner. Charlie transforms the dinner into
actual turkeys.
In the meantime, they're going on, what the heck's going on with that? They have no idea what the issue is.
Although they're all being very professional and very Starfleet about the whole thing.
Right. Or USBA-ish, whatever they want to be called at that time.
Right.
But they're beginning to get some weird vibes as it's going on. Actually, I think it's right before that scene, Charlie decides to ask Captain Kirk, why shouldn't he hit women on the butt? And Kirk can't give him a really clear answer, but he does say there's no right way to hit a woman. Among men, it's a different thing. You understand? He's like, not really.
But not only that, let me say, later on in the episode, you know, Kirk is giving him some very good advice about women, about just being like, hey, you know, just be yourself, chill out, let things happen as they will. You know, if something's going to develop, it will. If something's not going to develop, it won't. You know, just basically be yourself. Which I have to say, again, this is my first real experience to see Kirk as an everyday captain. Like, Picard would have been stumbling all over himself. You try to go to him, you know, if some kid went to him for advice about women, he'd be like, get, sing to them, goodbye.
Well, you know. You can also notice is that Kirk tries to pawn off the duty onto McCoy, and McCoy says, no, no, it's all on you. You're like the father figure that he's looking for.
Yeah.
I think the character actually does a pretty good job, but it's at this point that I believe we get a distress signal from the Antares.
And wait, hold on. Before we go to that, sure. I just wanted to quickly touch base. Ripples through Star Trek history. I remember it reminded me of the Data's episode with the hero worship where the kid tried to be like him. It also reminded me of the Jem'Hadar kid on DS9. You know, when they get the adolescent Jem'Hadar?
Right, where he grows like in 20 seconds, right.
That's correct. Similar. Yeah.
But I think Charlie has more of a human allegory of how we all deal with turning teenage and dealing with our emotions, except as later, as it's pointed out by Spock, is that you've got someone with the attempt to be an adult with teenage hormones running through him and with the power to do away with anyone who he dislikes.
And, you know, that's another thing. You could just see Gene Roddenberry recycling ideas later on. Because for a second I was like, is this kid a secret Q? Like, are these the people who gave him the powers, like...
The Thetians.
I mean, obviously it's proto-Q. And isn't... I heard tell from our good friends at Red Letter Media, Mike Stulcasa, they're watching their Star Trek trivia episode. There's like another Q-esque character later on, right? Yes, power behind the mirror. See it.
Yeah, that's later. That's talking about Trelane, but we're a ways away from that.
I know, but it's interesting that Gene Roddenberry obviously is like, ooh, wouldn't it be fun to have a character who's completely omnipotent?
Yes. We run into this several times. It's a theme. Also, it's a theme in science fiction in general with the omnipotent godlike creatures testing humans. But in this one, you've got some guy. President who's been given godlike powers, he just doesn't know how to govern them and control them. Kirk does at this point try and take Charlie and have him chill out by taking him to exercise. What'd you think of that exercise room?
Sweet ass Federation gi. I loved it. I loved him practicing his jiu-jitsu, like the Kirk tumble and using the moves that he would use on the Gorn. It's fantastic. Again, as a noob, I know that I've seen Kirk do tumble moves and flipping a guy over his shoulder during a fight, and I just never thought that I would see him practicing that in the show, and you know, just in general. And it's pretty rare. I mean, let's think here. When do we see Federation folks practicing their martial arts skills? The only thing I can really think of is Worf and Riker on the holodeck.
Right, but this actually is after a conversation that Kirk has in his quarters, telling Charlie he can't have everything. And actually, I have actually said the phrase myself, there are a million things in the universe you can have, and the million you can't, much to a eye roll or a sigh. But that's why he takes him to the gym. But you would think that Kirk would be more upset when he saw melted chess pieces that Charlie just played with. But whatever, we get to the gym.
Quick aside, the multi-level chess.
That blew me away.
I thought that was a TNG thing.
No. This came out here. There's still no actual real rule books to it. I actually have one of the sets I bought from Franklin. You could get it. Yes, I have lots of it. I have lots of stuff. But that Franklin Mint set is actually a nice glass and pewter set. But there's no rules on how to actually play it. It's one of the most fascinating things to look at, is to see this thing. And it's also one of the very first instances of you can see their recreation in the ship playing chess in the far, far future. But it's like space chess, the 3D right. chess. It's actually interesting. And I would suggest, you know, Franklin Mint still with making them and sponsoring. I'd say, come on over, because that's a great set to get.
Well, get a rule book there, and then maybe we can talk about it.
Yeah, that's true.
We reject your sponsorship that you've not yet offered us.
They're not going to be offering anything.
You've got to make a rule book.
They're in the gym. He's teaching him, and he says, Sam, come over here. And, Sam laughs at Charlie when Charlie gets thrown to the floor. So, and then he goes somewhere, except not the towel. But the guy goes somewhere. I thought that was kind of funny, actually, is that the guy disappears, but the towel stays. But I guess that's just a placement for items or something when he disappears. But that immediately makes Kurt get a little bit freaky. Not freaky, get a little bit freaked out. He calls for security, and the two, red shirts appear. Instead of going quietly, one of them pulls the phaser, and then suddenly all the phasers are gone. So they know they've got a serious problem on their hands. I don't know. Did you ever wish that you could rebel against authority figures when you were that age like that, Mike?
To be honest with you, I was mostly just frustrated with the other people around me who was that age. I always wanted to be an old man. It's getting better and better as I'm getting older. I'm 36 going on 65.
Yeah, it's great when you hear more creaking when you wake up. Trust me.
I know. That's happening. Wait, did I just say, talking about how delusional I am, I just said I'm 36. I'm 38. So.
Yeah, see, look at that. Yeah, no. I think maybe you need some Thasian sauce to remember.
Right. Oh, yeah. By the way, sorry, I'm Brandy. Talking about no replicators and noticeably no Scotty. No Chekhov, not even Sulu in this episode, but no Synthahol either. They got real booze, huh?
Yeah, they have real booze all the way through. It's a current theme. You'll see McCoy having hard liquor all the way through. It's interesting how in this version of Star Trek, people are more apt to have vices. They're not perfect paragons of human goodness. There's also more of a militant edge to all of them.
It's like
they are officers on an actual military vessel.
Absolutely. I mean, down to the fact that that guy was laughing at him for being a bit of a screw-up. I'm like, in TNG, they would be too woke and politically correct to laugh at someone's misfortune.
Oh, I don't know about woke. I'd probably be more like saying, like, oh, it's okay. Try again, Wesley. Oh, wait, wrong character. But Charles Evans, he's clearly a danger. I mean, Kirk, Spock, and McCoy are like, what the hell are we going to do here? They have him come to the briefing room, and they call him out on it. Did you destroy the Antares? Yeah, I did. And they're like, oh, geez. And we're heading towards a large colony where his family was from. We're really going to be in trouble if we do that. It was a little bit scared. What are they going to do? It's a really good question. At this point, Charlie takes over the entire ship, and he's wearing a very snazzy leather jacket, which you can never find anywhere on the internet.
You've looked.
Only time you ever see that leather wraparound. I actually like it.
It did make me wonder, in all your travels, you mentioned before in the previous episode that you've been quite the mainstay at the conventions. You even assisted some folks as their personal assistant. To Mrs. Gene Roddenberry.
Yes.
Did you ever cosplay?
Oh, yes. I actually have lots of costumes. In fact, this Halloween, I was part of Enterprise. I had my jumpsuit and everything, and I have the gold green wraparound Kirk shirt. I even have it from Strange New Worlds because it was just slightly more trim. And even got my wife to wear a short red skirt from original series, and I even have the monster maroon, and I made someone who's now 14 when he was like a year, dressed like Mr. Spock, and I've carried that on to the other one who's six. So,
Yes. Yeah. Now, is a teenager rebelling against dressing up like a Star Trek character?
Well, he doesn't wait. This year he was Top Gun, so I guess so. But he does like watching it. But he, we'll get to the episode he likes. I could tell you that one exactly. But what did you feel about with the triumphant Kirk, Spock, and McCoy trying to figure out what to do? Did you have any feeling of like dread or concern, or what were you thinking?
No, I mean, I mean, I can see obviously the appeal of the trio because, you know, starting from here, their beginningist of the beginnings, right up to the end of, you know, being on one of my favorite scenes in all of Star Trek when they're getting battered by the cloaked Klingon warbird in Undiscovered Country, and still all three of them band together to find a solution with the firing solution to the torpedo. They always have each other, and they always trust each other implicitly. And when all three of them are together, I never sense fear in any of them. It's a weird thing.
They do feed off of each other and they support each other. There is a sense that if they all work together, the three of them, you have Kirk more of like the middle, you've got McCoy as the emotional one, and obviously Spock as the unemotional one, and Kirk trying to balance the two. So he's kind of more of the rational out of all of it.
Of course.
Right. So it shows like a good leadership skill in that he's able to stoically command a situation. Again, no tears in any situation whatsoever.
Can you believe it? I know.
And no whispering either.
And no one talking about their love life.
Or who they got pregnant back on some starship. Right, or it's like saying, you know, one time I saw a family got washed away in a storm, and so that's why I rebelled against direct orders. That's not in this series. This is more of the stoic heroes going through it. It's at this point, I believe, we get back to the bridge. Charlie, and again, after he's now terrorizing the crew, turning another yeoman into a lizard. Younger woman into an old lady, takes away a face of another.
And by the way, that old lady thing was really messed up. You know why? Because usually in Star Trek, they just slap some unrealistic old age makeup on a young woman. And like, oh no, look, she's old. They put some, you know, talcum powder in her hair. They just cast an old lady. And they were like, okay, you're 65, which you're actually 65, and you're horrified by that fact. React.
Yeah. What's it saying about everybody?
I know.
Why also turn a woman into like a lizard, by the way? I guess, you know, it's an interesting commentary what Charlie thinks of the younger, the other yeoman who's allegedly 17, same age as him. It makes you wonder how young you can actually join to join the fleet.
Right. Charlie X, the first incel.
That's right. But then they get up to the bridge. Kirk realizes that Charlie can't take on more than he can chew because the Antares is a heck of a lot smaller with 20 people. This is 428, at least this instance, and it's got a lot more doodads and gizmos. So they come up with the idea of turn everything on and let's see him run the ship, which he begins to freak out about. When it's at this point that we come to our ending where the Thasians actually appear. And in a very creepy ending, they say, listen, either he comes with us or you're going to have to either kill him or he's going to have to kill you.
Yeah.
It actually stops Kirk from punching him in the face, punching Charlie in the face. But that last scene is what always sticks with me, where he's just standing there saying, I want to stay. That's why I think one of the creepiest things I've ever seen ever in Star Trek, and even when I was younger, like 6 or 7 years old when I'm watching this for the first time in the 70s, because I'm old, that scene stuck in my head of like one of the most creepiest things. In fact, that's the two things that stand out the most is that jacket and that he wants to stay type of thing. What were your thoughts towards that?
Yeah, no, I mean, a couple of different notes I have here. First of all, the blank face thing, the sealed up face, that's some great body horror. And it does show, you know, I think that it was Harlan Ellison, famous sci-fi writer, who said that, like, Star Trek was essentially a horror series. Like, it really was people kind of coming into terrifying, oftentimes a monster of the week scenarios and kind of having horrible things happen to them. That was a really disturbing image. And also, again, interesting echoes of future Trek. This is not the first time, and it's certainly, you know, no, this is the first time, and it would certainly not be the last time that we are seeing a bridge crew come into contact with beings that are so far beyond them that they don't have any real say in what happens next. You see that in the Nth Degree when Barclay brings them to that whatever central nebula. And again, we got a floating head in that. We got a floating head in this. Also in the TNG episode Clues, we are encountering an alien intelligence that is just might as well be a Q, might as well be gods, being like, listen, we don't want to, but we can destroy you, so why don't you just move along? And it does show that, you know, Roddenberry was aware of the place of man in the universe, that he has to be humble in order to know his place, that he's not the top of the food chain. And, you know, they really experience that later on when they're saying we can handle anything, and Q introduces them to the Borg.
Well, that comes up later. You'll even see it. The Enterprise crew here is actually humbled quite a few times in multiple situations.
Sure.
But they just are able to think as opposed to consistently lash out at you either by having shooting everything or crying over a solution. They actually think and discuss and take opinions of everyone. That's more in TNG, where they have a meeting every 5 minutes. But in the original series, they actually do reason it out. And it's, although it does concentrate on the main three characters, the ancillary characters do come in at times. And there is more than just Scotty, Uhura, Chekhov. There are other characters, as you'll see later, that actually have some input here.
I am kind of curious about that, I'm not going to lie. Also, I really like the ending in that it was also one of the first of many, like, no-win situations where there's not an ideal outcome. The Kobayashi Maru test, where, you know, you just have to kind of admit defeat, because we see that in Tuvix, where Janeway is like, well, I know that you're a sentient form of life, but I have to kill you. Also,
Tuvix must die. Tuvix must die.
Well, I mean, also, this really, I don't know if you got this, Matt, but did this remind you of the Voyager episode, The Thaw, with the creepy clown guy?
It kind of, well, no, actually it didn't remind me of, you know, Mr. McKeon as a creepy clown guy, but what it reminded me, I don't know if I could relate it to anything in TNG as well, except again, it's the all-powerful being like Q, but just that entire thing where we're going to just take this guy out of here because we can. You know, sorry about all the terror and the death of 20 other people and ruining your, taking away all your weapons and so forth. But, you know, everything's okay now.
I thought that everyone was restored.
Well, that's what they say. Did we see Sam come back?
No, I didn't get a vibe that they lost a bunch of people on this one. Yeah, and by the way, you know, interesting stuff. So far, if I was a critic, I'd say, well, you just basically had two episodes back-to-back that were very similar to each other. You know, they're both threat comes on the ship, threat seems innocent at first, threat slowly escalates and becomes a bigger threat, and eventually they find out what exactly is going on, and then the threat's removed, being the salt monster.
That's the basic premise of every adventure show. So, but it's interesting about how, like you were saying, like it kind of just ends, and there's no real, there's no happy ending here. It just ends. They're like, well, I guess you could say it's happy in the fact that they're still all alive, because that's one of the things that Kirk realizes, is that, you know, even if we do what he says, he's going to just kill us all because he wants to. It's a little bit disturbing, and at least when they at least fly away knowing they're alive. But what of poor Charlie?
That's a really interesting question. Like, I've never seen an outcome like that where it's like, well, he's not getting killed and he's not even getting imprisoned. He's basically, it's a very sad ending, because it's almost like, you know, it's almost like you saved a lion cub, right? And humans saved a lion cub and they raised him in a zoo, and then they tried to reintroduce him to the other lions in a pride, and he was just acting like a jerk and couldn't follow the rules. And then it's like, you got to come back with us. I know you don't want to. I know it's unnatural, but you're not meant for anything anymore. You're a man between multiple worlds. I'm kind of curious. I mean, that would be an amazing thing for, you know, Strange New Worlds or Lower Decks.
No, they something. Won't do that. You have to be creative to do that, Mike.
Well, I mean, it would be a really interesting sequel episode to be like, hey, whatever happened to Charlie X? Because it could be 1,000 years in the future. Yeah, presumably, he might live forever, just like these whatever they
Thasians.
Are.
Yeah, the Thasians. Yeah, it would have been an interesting story, but they are never heard of again. But it is kind of so like far. You do have to wonder, what happened to Charlie? What happened to these Thasians? Are they quarantined from the rest of the fleet, the Federation, or USPA? Only because they seem like they can do anything, and they would be quite terrifying as a adversary, just wishing things away.
Well, they seem, that's the thing, they're pretty cool, because they seem like they've got power similar to Q, but also with way more wisdom. Like, you know, in the Voyager episode, we see that the Q continuum, they're just like devastatingly bored. Well, right. In, you know, maybe the Thasians managed to become omnipotent while also preserving a culture.
But, you know, what's also interesting is not only is that is that the one that appears also, I just wanted to address one thing, because I always find it interesting, is that he says he took on this form. So yeah. They must had some sort of contact with the outside world for some reason, or the outside universe, that is. So. Right. That was also, to me, it's also very creepy seeing that melty face, or that flowing face on the bridge.
Yeah, no, that was some good stuff.
Go ahead. I was just gonna say, overall, I enjoyed this episode. Did you enjoy it? Are you excited to see the next one?
Yes, I am. That being said, I enjoyed this a lot. Right, I dug it. It was very, very similar in terms of structure to the previous episode, and I remember what you said last time, that it was aired in an order that Gene Roddenberry did not intend. So I am curious if, you know, basically he would not have put such a similar episode one after the other. But don't tell me anything else, because I want to see if the third episode is the same as the first two.
Well, the third episode is actually supposed to be the premiere episode. It's Where No Man Has Gone Before, and I look forward to seeing it with you, and I hope the rest of you can find time to join us on Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies and share and subscribe and all that stuff. And we can see you on the next episode.
Don't end this yet. Hold on. I got questions.
He's got questions. Go ahead.
Is this the one with the guy with a character named John Harrison?
I'm sorry. What about John Harrison? That one who was like Khan Noonien Singh in the second JJ movie?
Does this third episode have a character named John Harrison in it?
I don't believe it has an episode, a guy named John Harrison then in it. You have to watch it and see.
Disregard. Also, you did mention that you had a Strange New Worlds costume, which is bizarre. Yes. I never would have thought that my Captain Matt Ross would have deigned. So I'm just going to see if you can finish this line, okay? I'm going to give it to you?
You could try.
I have to give credit when due.
You have to stop. You're going into the singing Strange New Worlds episode.
Come on, can you not finish that line?
No, I really can't, because I dislike that episode.
And if I make captain, it'll be thanks to all of you.
Yeah, I just bought the shirt because it was on sale at AliExpress. So
okay, well, I'm just telling you. Listen, that episode, not bad. I'm a sucker for musicals.
According to me. But anyway, it was a lot of fun talking with you again on this.
And, same.
We're going to see where no man has gone before in our next episode.
Yes.
And you all join us then.
Same bad time, same bad channel.
That's right. And join us next time at Yelling at Gaseous Anomalies.
Yes, see sir. You. Bye, sir.